I've never felt comfortable with really large producers and the way that the food process is going.
A food safety bill that doesn't impact small farmers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 30th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, taking stock of words versus actions.
Those who voted to ban earmarks but also asked for earmarks can have it both ways.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska senators are both reviewing a Pentagon report unveiled today on the effects of repealing the law banning gays in the military. It concludes that getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell presents little risk to the troops' ability to carry out missions and says 70% of service members surveyed believed it would have little or no effect on their units. It's up to the Senate whether or not to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell as part of the Defense Authorization Bill. Senator Mark Begich supports getting rid of the anti-gay policy and points to American allies in Iraq and Afghanistan who do not have such policies and have not had problems either in their own ranks or when working with U.S. troops. He says it's time to move forward.
The fact is, everyone asked to get a survey done. Survey's done. Majority of the survey says, what I understand is, no big deal. Okay, so now are we going to listen to the troops or are we going to use political judgment here? And my worry is there's going to be more politics.
Begich sits on the Senate Armed Services Committee, which will take testimony on the study Thursday from Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mike Mullen, and top military leaders. Republicans are largely against repeal, but Senator Lisa Murkowski could be a possible swing vote. She said she wanted to wait for the study's results and make sure repeal wouldn't hurt troop morale and recruitment. This evening, Murkowski hadn't yet had a chance to scrutinize the newly released report, but said her top military staffer was reading it and she plans to dig into it.
It was important that we ask the question of the men and women in the field. It's equally important that we review the response, and we'll now have an opportunity to do that. And I'm going to be looking critically at it.
Murkowski has said Democrats should not rush passage of the Defense Authorization Bill and its repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. She's calling for deliberations on the Senate floor, but the lame duck session must wrap up by the end of the year, and there's much on the agenda. Gridlock may be the prevailing theme on Capitol Hill, but Senator Lisa Murkowski and 14 other Republicans joined with Democrats, including Begich, to pass a bipartisan food safety bill this morning. It's the biggest change in the laws governing food production in 70 years. It requires more inspections of food manufacturers and processing plants, sets new standards for imported food, and gives the Food and Drug Administration the authority to recall contaminated food. Right now, the FDA can only ask companies to voluntarily do so. Consumer groups support the bill, as do large food growers. Small local farmers have had concerns that it would be too burdensome for them, but a Democratic amendment exempts small farmers who sell locally and make less than $500,000. Alaska Senator Mark Begich says the small farmers amendment, pushed by Montana Senator John Tester, alleviated his concerns, so he signed on as a co-sponsor.
Farmers markets, especially in Alaska, which are now a growing industry, and one who shops at them is very excited that we've made sure that those will continue the way they have been operating. But the bigger issue on food safety is these larger production plants that, as you know, we've had egg recalls, we've had cheese recall, we've had meat recalls, and in the tune of millions and millions of products.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says there are Alaska-oriented amendments she inserted during the committee process. One calls for the FDA to do a study on the transportation of food in rural and frontier areas, and another directs the FDA to update the Fish and Fisheries Products Hazards and Control Guidance, which helps seafood processors develop their hazard analysis and critical control points. It was last updated 9 years ago.
It is an issue that I had hoped that we would have resolved prior to this time, so I was pleased that we saw final passage.
The House has already passed similar food safety legislation, but now the Senate language goes back to the House for final approval. River Bean is the owner of Arctic Organics in the Mat-Su Valley. He says he was relieved there was an exemption for small farmers since the scares over food contamination and recalls all stemmed from large corporate farms and the processors, not small growers.
If one thing is contaminated, a whole lot is contaminated because they'll use the same water to cut corners here or there rather than wash every batch. Individually, they'll wash it all together. So everything gets contaminated that comes in contact with whatever they're doing.
Bean says he's hopeful the law will help the FDA better supervise large agricultural businesses.
I think this will help a lot. It'll give the FDA some teeth to put into it. But, time will tell if it's actually working or not.
Bean says he'd like to say small family farms are making a resurgence, but he says it's still very difficult for small farmers to compete with corporate growers. Attached to the food safety bill was an attempt by Senator Tom Coburn to ban earmarks. It failed on a vote of 39-56, and both of Alaska senators voted against it. Even though it failed, it was a stronger anti-earmark showing than the Senate has had in the past. APRN's Libby Casey has more.
Senator Murkowski was one of just 8 Republicans to reject the call to get rid of earmarks. Earlier this month, the Republican conference voted for a self-imposed earmark ban. Murkowski says the fact that she's not alone in still supporting earmarks despite the GOP ban positions her in a solid group.
Some strength in numbers there, if you will. And I think that as long as the case is made by the lawmaker for the request, we ought not be afraid to stand up and represent our states and our states' interests.
Murkowski says she still thinks she'll be able to direct funding home, but she'll likely have to work harder to defend projects.
Maybe what it's going to take is greater effort from the folks back home to ensure that these are really the heightened priorities within those communities.
Murkowski says that means seeing communities or the state offer to match federal funds or pass resolutions declaring a project their number one priority. On the Democratic side of the aisle, 7 senators supported the earmark ban, but not Begich. Begich says it was a chance for senators to put their money where their mouth is and show exactly where they stand. He's suggesting that senators who voted to ban earmarks stop asking for them when it comes time to dole out the money.
Today's vote probably gave us an opportunity to look at some of the projects and eliminate them. Those who voted to ban earmarks but also asked for earmarks can't have it both ways. So maybe there's some more shaving that can be done to save some more taxpayer money.
Democrats have not banned earmarks within their ranks. The anti-earmark sponsor, Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn, has railed against earmarks and has stopped bills from passing because he didn't like specific projects, including ones for Alaska. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering an Alaskan historian who regretted the title.
As long as people are interested in the Alaska story, they'll be able to go to Bob DeArmond's writing and look through those windows and see what the world was like.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The venue change of candidate Joe Miller's lawsuit against the state of Alaska has put a new wrinkle in the ongoing saga of Alaska's U.S. Senate election. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who has claimed victory in her write-in campaign for her seat in Congress, has asked to intervene in the suit, although at this time it's not certain if the courts will allow that. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Fairbanks Judge Douglas Blankenship said hearing Miller's complaint in Fairbanks would pose a hardship for the state. Blankenship said it may have been necessary to move the ballots from Juneau to Fairbanks for inspection, and that could further jeopardize the election's integrity. Joe Miller said Monday that he understood the judge's concerns, although later the Miller campaign sent out an email saying, quote, "The state of Alaska argued that it could not guarantee the chain of custody and security of the ballots if they were shipped from Juneau to Fairbanks." Miller did not challenge the court's decision. He spoke with reporters at a press conference on Monday.
Next is, obviously, we've got to make sure that we're prepared for the hearing later on this week. We're going to make sure that we've got people on the ground in Juneau. You know, we're going to continue the process of the review that's going on right now. We're looking at precinct registers, reviewing other material that's coming in. You know, we're just doing what we've been doing.
The Miller campaign continues its review of voter logs to look for irregularities surrounding the Senate race. Miller campaign spokesman Randy DeSoto says the campaign has gone through about one-third of the precinct logs. Meanwhile, Lisa Murkowski's attorneys have indicated that Miller is distorting the truth. In a filing Monday, Murkowski attorneys pointed to ballots challenged by the Miller camp that had Lisa Murkowski perfectly spelled on them. The furor over the Senate election and its increasingly complicated aftermath has seized headlines across the state, headlines which often ignore the voters' viewpoint. But Fairbanks voter Joanna Pippinger, who wrote in for Murkowski, confronted Miller to his face on Monday.
And I feel disenfranchised by what you're doing here. I wrote Republican. She is a Republican. That's a fact. So are you. And I feel very disenfranchised by this. It's not just your voters who are feeling disenfranchised.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize is that when you have the legislature that enacts a law, and the legislature says that the provisions in that law are mandatory, that there are no exceptions, for us to later then go out and game what the legislature meant by that and say, well, look, even though the legislature, when it passed this law, meant one thing today, because it means something to us or because it feels good to us, we want to apply it a different way, it leaves that decision in a bureaucrat's hand.
Pippinger was an Election Day observer and a volunteer for the Murkowski campaign.
And I feel disenfranchised by the acts that Joe Miller is making. I feel that, yes, he threw out my vote along with 8,251 other votes.
Miller says he's suing because the state's laws concerning write-in votes need clarification.
The question is, are we going to leave the decision about that statute to a bureaucrat or to somebody that bases the decision on the whims of the circumstances, or are we going to be honest and say, look, the legislature intended this?
A status hearing is set for the Miller case on Wednesday in Juneau. Attorneys for the state want a judge to decide the case outright unless Miller provides proof to back up claims of fraud, which the attorneys call unfounded. With help from Dan Bross, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Robert D'Armond is being remembered this week as among the foremost of Alaska's historians, although D'Armond himself might not have seen it that way. D'Armond died last Friday in the Sitka Pioneers Home, where he had resided for the last 19 years. Friends say the 99-year-old D'Armond was averse to the label historian and instead saw himself simply as a researcher of past events with no desire to argue for a particular point of view. Whatever the case, D'Armond had a lifelong passion for detail that was likely unequaled in Alaska. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Bob was, first and foremost, a journalist, a terrific newsman.
Thad Polson is the editor and publisher of the Daily Sitka Sentinel. In 1968, Polson was the lone Associated Press correspondent for the entire state of Alaska, based in Juneau. He met Bob D'Armond through some mutual friends and discovered that he was not so alone, at least professionally, as he first thought.
I recall two elections, statewide elections, when I had to go to Anchorage. And Bob sat in for me. He covered the AP office during the days that I was out. Did a superb job. Yeah, he had his journalism chops all along.
Journalism chops indeed. About 10 years earlier, D'Armond, along with businessman Robert Henning, co-founded the Alaska Sportsman, which is now published as Alaska Magazine. D'Armond would eventually sell out his share and work for Henning editing the Alaska Journal, a quarterly. D'Armond began and ended his career in journalism, starting first as a reporter for Strollers Weekly in Juneau, not long after his graduation from high school in Tacoma, Washington in 1930. He would eventually work for the Alaska Fishing News, which later became the Ketchikan Daily News, and the Juneau Empire. He covered the biennial sessions of the Alaska Territorial Legislature from 1946 to 1953. He would contribute to almost every publication in the state, particularly as his reputation for detailed historical research grew. Thad Poulsen says that DeArmond eventually came back to newspapering, writing hundreds of columns on local history for the Daily Sentinel beginning in 1985. Poulsen says DeArmond knew the people and resources to plug the decades-long absence of a regular newspaper in Sitka. But he says despite sharply honed skills compiling history, DeArmond, with only 1 year of college under his belt, never admitted to the title.
From time to time, when he would be referred to as Sitka's historian or Alaska's historian, he would make the very fine point, which most people don't agree with, that I'm not an historian at all. He says, I simply write down the history that's been established. A historian is someone who puts a viewpoint and draws conclusions on what he is writing about what happened in the past. I simply write down what happened.
Much of that writing found its way into books, 17 in all that he either wrote or edited, and many more that relied on his work, such as John McPhee's Coming Into the Country.
He knew Alaskan history like no one else.
Alaskan novelist and poet John Straley first sought out DeArmond when he learned that the out-of-work reporter had rowed a dory from Sitka back to Tacoma in 1931.
He was a great resource to talk with when in trying to write a story because, you know, I can do research about fashions and, you know, I can look at old catalogs to see what men and women were wearing. But questions of culture, of time, and like I would ask him, okay, so a woman in that area was going out in a boat. What would she wear in that in 1933? What kind of clothes would she be wearing? And we would have discussions about it. And also I'd ask him about cursing and things like that, which are hard things to track down. And he was very blunt and very honest about it.
DeArmond's rowboat journey was pivotal for both authors. The publicity about the voyage in the Tacoma papers would lead to his reacquaintance with a friend from school, Dale Burleson. The couple eventually married and would remain so for over 70 years. DeArmond would finally publish his account of the tale in the book A Voyage in a Dory in 1991. John Straley wrote six novels while the idea of DeArmond's trip simmered in his mind. His seventh, The Big Both Ways, features an epic rowboat journey up the coast by an unlikely trio escaping labor unrest in the Pacific Northwest. Straley dedicated the novel to DeArmond.
When he did this, this is a young man that had a bullet in his leg, and he rowed one to get across Dixon Entrance, I believe. He rowed 27 hours straight. He gained 45 pounds of muscle weight in the trip down there, and it was just matter of fact to him. He opened windows to the past that will stay open forever. As long as people are interested in the Alaska story, they'll be able to go to Bob DeArmond's writing and look through those windows and see what the world was like.
Straley says he gave DeArmond a copy of The Big Both Ways to read in manuscript, and he appeared to take pleasure in correcting some misspellings and other minor details in the novel. Straley says, I just accepted that my book wouldn't be as good as his. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The state of Alaska is offering grants to rural areas as part of the Initiative Against Domestic Violence. Melissa Stone, Behavioral Health Director for the State Department of Health and Social Services, says recent studies link traumatic childhood experiences to drug, alcohol, and tobacco abuse and obesity in adults. Stone says the state is seeking ideas from rural areas on how to build violence-free communities.
The grants are focused on rural areas where we hope to encourage community agencies and individuals to work together to come up with some creative responses and ideas for how to make a difference in domestic violence.
Stone says the grants are intended to link stakeholders and to expand the breadth of prevention services.
What we're looking for is a community evaluation process to begin with, where interested individuals and agencies in a community get together to look at the circumstances in their community that are contributing to domestic violence.
Primary grants of $500,000 will go to a regional or community coalition that can serve several surrounding smaller towns and villages. The original grant could be expanded to as much as $1 million over 3 years. 2 to 3 additional grants of around $200,000 will go to other communities.
This is different because there's a focus of funds specifically on primary prevention and early intervention, and historically our funds have been more focused on emergency victim services or separately behavioral health services. So this is an opportunity to bring communities together to really look at how can they make a difference in intervening earlier, working together in different ways.
Successful applicants will need to bring forward new ideas, demonstrate community involvement in assessing regional issues, and identify results they intend to accomplish.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The priest of St. Gregory Catholic Church in Sitka has been removed from public ministry while authorities investigate questionable material found on parish computers. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Father Edmund Penniston arrived at St. Gregory Church in October after 8 years in Ketchikan. Church officials were alerted to a possible problem about 2 weeks ago.
A computer program that had been installed on the computers at St. Gregory's indicated that some questionable material had been accessed.
That's Father Pat Travers, the Vicar General of the Diocese of Juneau. He says Bishop Edward Burns immediately asked Penniston to step aside and contacted police. Travers says he doesn't know what the questionable material on the computers consisted of. Sitka Police Lieutenant Barry Allen says computers from the church were sent to Anchorage for analysis. The results of those tests are still pending. No charges have been filed. Travers of the diocese says the next step is to find out what authorities find on the computers and assess the possible consequences.
In the meantime, Father Penniston won't be in public ministry, and at some point there will probably be an assessment of where he is psychologically and pastorally.
Bishop Burns led the Mass last weekend in Sitka and held a town hall meeting for parishioners on Saturday night. Travers says those in attendance had lots of questions.
It sounds like they were concerned, but at the same time seemed to give him the feedback that they were confident about the way he was handling things.
Charles Horan is on the parish council at St. Gregory. He said members of the congregation are, quote, very grieved, unquote, by recent events. The bishop is expected to return to Sitka this weekend and lead masses. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and the North Slope Borough officials are considering filing suit against the U.S. Department of Interior over its decision to designate a vast area of Alaska's north coast as critical habitat for polar bears. KBRW's Jake Neer has the story.
ASRC Vice President of External Affairs Tara Sweeney says she thinks the people of the North Slope are bearing the brunt of federal regulation.
This is a quality of life issue for the people of the North Slope, and the burden of this designation is going to be felt by the people of the North Slope instead of targeting perhaps industries as far away as Ohio who are contributing to climate change. We're being held accountable for something that's happening all across this country and actually all across the circumpolar region.
The critical habitat designation, or CHD, is being administered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, FWS officials said in a release last week, approximately 96% of the area is sea ice habitat. They say it identifies geographic areas containing features considered essential for the conservation of the bear that require special management or protection. The designation of critical habitat does not affect land ownership or establish a refuge, wilderness, reserve, preserve, or other conservation area. The villages of Barrow and Koktovik are exempt from the critical habitat area, as are five Air Force facilities. But Sweeney says she worries the communities might still be affected.
There may be exemptions for structures that are already in place, but if we're looking at building a playground in one of our communities and it's using federal funds or requires a federal permit, we're going to have to go through another layer of government bureaucracy just to get that done. And so our concern is, again, that it flash freezes our communities in time.
Sweeney says she believes the CHD will do nothing to address climate change or increase the population of polar bears while burdening the people of the North Slope. North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta also released a statement last week expressing his displeasure with the designation. He says he thinks local officials were largely ignored in the decision-making process.
And I feel sometimes like we're pawns up here. We seem to be an afterthought. I still don't feel that anybody really has come up here and answered our questions on just specifically what does this mean for us, instead of just assurances, oh, everything will go on as before, nothing is going to change.
He believes the regulation targets the people of the North Slope, even though they are not radically contributing to the loss of sea ice. He says the new designation creates an illusion in other parts of the country that polar bears are safe in the Arctic, while urban and industrial areas thousands of miles away continue to emit large amounts of greenhouse gas.
And I recognize the polar bear as an icon, and we as Inupiaq have always respected and lived with the polar bear, and have all the respect in the world for it. But look, there are humans living up here. There are jobs dependent on these decisions, and we have very few of them.
Governor Sean Parnell also expressed disapproval of the critical habitat designation and the process leading to its creation. He says state officials are also considering legal action against the federal government over the matter. The North Slope Borough and ASRC officials say they are keeping all options open moving forward, including legal action together and with the state of Alaska. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey and Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Jake Neer in Barrow. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
And by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.